Hello and welcome to Around the Houses, the ultimate guide for anyone looking to buy overseas property or indeed existing property owners that live outside the UK. Brought to you by UK Mortgages, a partner practice of St James's Place. Every episode will feature property experts discussing a range of topics including tax, lending and market overviews, helping you make better, more informed decisions. I hope you enjoy it.
My name's Neil Jensen. And I'm very pleased to welcome Rupert Smith today, who is founder and MD of Complete RPI in the UK. Rupert, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, kind sir. Neil, how are you?
Very, very well indeed. It's very good to have you on.
Thank you very much, kind sir. I believe the last time we spoke, I was in the middle of a field on Exmoor in a camper van. Am I right?
Yes, this is actually take two on this podcast.
No cows and reception, which is a bonus.
And strong Wi-Fi.
Indeed. Indeed, indeed.
Rupert, tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do, please.
Thoroughly nice gentleman. I have enjoyed 32 years of being in the property industry, from working as a negotiator for a national real estate firm at the age of 16 through to running 60 branches of estate agency in London, the southeast, and then finally, I promised myself by the time I was 30, I'd be running my own show. And here we are 20 years later. Complete RPI has just celebrated its 20th birthday in April this year. So it's all been property, property, property all the way through in a number of different guises, from the residential housing sector through to investment and asset management and property management, which is where we are today with offices in the UK and indeed Hong Kong. We're celebrating our 20th year and one of our busiest years we've ever had. So it's exciting times at the moment, Neil.
Great. And what does a lettings and management company actually do, Rupert?
That's a phenomenally good question, and I'm sure you'll get many different answers from many different people, but if you ask them the same question, as you know only too well yourself. What does a lettings and management company do? First and foremost, predominantly a lettings business will source you a tenant for your rented investment property, and they will verify the quality of that occupant, and they'll prepare the associated paperwork and make sure that everything is produced in a format that makes it legal, through to the management of the real estate, which is the physical day-to-days, so production of, as I said, of associated paperwork, transferring of utilities, to the physical management, dealing with any maintenance issues that pop up, such as washing machine repairs or loo repairs, through to rental arrears, through to making sure the property is up to speed with managed certification, through to rental collection from the tenant directly, and then going through that whole process again. So lettings and management in its truest form is to identify and verify the best quality of occupant through to physically collecting the rent and managing that property, reducing and keeping the costs low and maintaining occupancy as best you possibly can. That's a sort of vanilla side to the business. We, of course, do far more than that, Neil, as well you know, but that's predominantly what a lettings and management company does.
It might be a silly question, but why wouldn't someone do this themselves or ask a family member to help with it? Now, bear in mind that all of our clients that are listening to this are likely to be living outside of the UK.
Very good question. Been there, done that. And 95% of our client base are international. So we're very well versed with looking after people in different countries and different time zones, and we're set up accordingly to do so. It's an interesting question. More often than not, when people manage real estate for and on behalf of friends, friends and family, it's fraught with danger. First and foremost, its legislation is changing on a daily basis, and it's so vitally important to make sure that property is compliant. Compliant in terms of the correct mandatory certification for electrical matters or gas or Legionnaires' disease, or making sure the correct tenancy agreement's in play. There's constant changes in legislation, constant changes in tenancy law. And if you're not on top of those, you can be caught up. And there are hefty fines and indeed potential imprisonment as a landlord if you don't comply with that legislation. And the legislation is there for a reason. We as a business are registered, the Association of Residential Letting Agents, from members of the TDS, the Tenancy Deposit Scheme, the Deposit Protection Service, everything you can possibly be to make sure we keep on top of that legislation and that ever-changing legislation. Just things like gas safety certificates, electrical safety certificates, hugely important to make sure that property is compliant. If there was ever an incident or an accident, you can be you can be held responsible for that. So through to ongoing changes, I mean, this past 12 months have been challenging, to say the least, from everyone's perspective, relating to COVID. Example of that being the correct notice period to exit a tenant. If your tenant doesn't pay their rent and your tenant is not willing to leave the premises, you've got a very strict process in which to go through. You've got very strict laws which you need to comply with to make sure you can exit that tenant. Previously, you'd only have to give 60 days notice to exit a tenant, but during the COVID period, it's been up to 6 months. Unless you're on top of that legislation, you don't know this. So in answer to your question, my granny wouldn't necessarily know that all these changes in legislation, and I wouldn't necessarily want her to have the responsibility to manage those things. So friends and family, yes, you can save some money, but invariably it's quite short-sighted by dint of the fact you can end up in a right old pickle if you don't follow legislation and law accordingly.
And you might not get any Christmas.
No, but not that my granny wouldn't do a fantastic job with PR liaising with those tenants. And I'm sure she'd be around there every 5 minutes making a fine cup of tea and a scone. But from a legislation perspective, I suspect it probably wouldn't go that well.
I'm not going to ask how old she is.
She's a mere whippersnapper at 82. And makes a mean cream tea, I'll have you know. Now, brilliant. Speaking of cream teas, Neil, do you know the difference between, in your view, would you put the cream on top of the scone and then the strawberry jam, or would you do it the other way around? I'm interested in the modern approach here. I beg your pardon?
The jam on first.
Jam on first. Okay, I think, ladies and gents, probably now time that we cancel this podcast. You can't do that. That's sacrilege. Everyone knows it's cream first. When you're a Devon boy, it's cream first, then the jam.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well,
digress.
I'm going to ruin it and just say I wouldn't put either on. I'd probably put butter on it, and I'd have had it in the microwave first to warm it up. So there you
butter's go. Butter's allowed.
Okay, so you've been going 20 years.
Yep.
And you said it was always your intention to start it. Now, I can remember when I started my business, it was more on the fact that it was almost of the adage of, if you want a job done properly, do it yourself. Was that similar to you, or was there more of a game plan as to what you wanted to do?
No, I think I'd been in the industry for so long, and I'd learned so many different elements about the industry. I'd always wanted to be the captain of my own ship. I got frustrated with the way in which other companies were working, and it became very apparent to me pre sort of buy-to-let boom in the early 2000s. Lots of my clients were saying to me, Rupert, you know, we like what you do, but the management isn't that great. And this is when I was working for a much larger organization and not on my own. And there were frustrations that were common. Plus, the clients were not being serviced properly. And I realized that there was a huge overseas investor base that wasn't receiving the best possible advice. And what I mean by that is that we provide much more of an asset managed approach to owning real estate as an asset class. UK real estate agents are much more reactive to physically managing the real estate, which is great. But if you're investing, you know, a large chunk of change, and in some people's cases, the most amount of money they ever would have exposed in any single asset class, you need to make sure that that's managed properly. And what I mean by that is understanding what the investors' motives are, how long they wanted to invest for, why they're looking to invest. Is it income they're after? Is it capital growth? Is it a blend of the two? And what I realized was that there was a gap in the market to provide much more of an asset managed approach to the ownership of resi, from search and acquisition to letting to management to overall asset management, and then ending the life cycle with sale at the back end. And also providing that service to the overseas investor on a national basis, because again, we realized that a lot of frustration from investors' perspective, where they're having to go to multiple letting agents in different locations. So you, Neil, living in Hong Kong, say you own a property in London, you own a property in Birmingham, and you've got a child at school in Oxford, you've got property spread around the country, and you're having to interface with multiple parties. What I realized was the ability to provide a single point of contact and manage that portfolio predominantly online with a single point of contact was much easier for you being an investor overseas, that you could utilize a platform that you didn't have to wait for the UK to open, and or you can. That's the reason why we set up a Hong Kong office, is to engage in real time, but to provide that much more holistic end-to-end asset managed approach to real estate, rather than rocking up at the Mandarin on a Sunday feeling a bit flush and going, right, I want to go and buy a bit of real estate because my mates have done the same thing. Actually applying some logic to that process and saying, what do I want? Why do I want it? How do I fund it? How do I structure it? And then how do I get it let and managed? So in a very long-winded response to your question, that was my answer.
And in these days of COVID, and hopefully getting to post-COVID, what changes have you had to make to the business to adapt to what's happening now in the marketplace? I mean, your ability, you know, you've been to Hong Kong many, many times, and your ability to get on a plane at short notice to come and attend an exhibition or visit key clients has been taken away, hasn't it? Probably for the last year and a half. So what changes have you had to make to align the business to that?
Good question. Well, first and foremost, we have an office and we have multilingual staff in Hong Kong. So that is very important to make sure we have people on the ground real time. But predominantly communication. It's all about communication and the way in which, you know, I think we communicated very well with our client base during COVID. We kept people constantly updated as to what was going on. You know, of course, it had huge challenges with an entire workforce working from home. I think it focused the mind heavily on communication. It focused the mind heavily on potential new software as well, because, you know, it is all about, you know, communicating not only the verbal word but the ability to go online. And we realized that by producing the very best prop tech also meant that our clients would benefit from that without having to get on the telephone, without having to wait for someone to pick up the telephone. So I think predominantly it's about efficiency, it's about communication, it's about process, it's about delivery. And I think that's, you know, that was a very interesting learning curve for us. Now, you know, we strive to do the very best we can. We strive to provide the best possible service. But I don't think you can do that unless you really challenge your processes and your communication levels.
And very quickly, one last question about Complete RPI. How many properties do you manage at the moment, and where are they situated around the UK in general?
The number of properties under management is changes on a daily basis, because we also take on a lot of property for clients that have bought off plan, so they're committed to that. But anyone given in any one moment in time, circa 2,000 units. The stretch of that portfolio is UK nationwide. So we manage a portfolio from just south of Scotland all the way down to Wales, with density mostly in London, Southeast, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, university corridors, and the like. So it's quite a spread portfolio. Invariably, clients quite like the blend of both capital growth and yield. Therefore, investing in different locations in the UK is quite a smart thing to do. So you can get that balance of the both. Hence the reason why we have quite a bit of diversity in terms of location.
And you've made some quite interesting developments on your website over time to enhance that as well, haven't you?
Yes, we have. And we have just launched our brand new website, which has been a year in the making, turned me even greyer than I was before, bearing in mind my knowledge of such things is quite limited, but I've learned a hell of a lot. I'm very pleased to say that in conjunction with our 20th birthday, we've just launched a brand new website, which is much more user-friendly. We have a client login portal, which is incredibly well-received, so our clients can go online and review management statements, sign contracts electronically. They can review interim inspection reports, essentially anything related to the tenancy. You can now log in through your own private portal. Furthermore, there's a tenants portal, which offers the same platform of signing contracts electronically and inspection reports, thus like, but also making payments. But the key element to that is also the ability to report maintenance issues through that portal. Part and parcel of our job, going back to your question of what do we do, part and parcel of our job is to make sure we super efficiently manage the day-to-day running of that property in a cost-effective manner. So we realized that by creating a software platform that meant the tenants physically had to go through the platform to log a maintenance issue, rather than just picking up the phone or just us getting out a contractor without understanding the full nuances of what the problem was and whose fault it was, by utilizing a platform to physically report. And what I mean by that is that, so the tenant's washing machine was broken, they'd have to go online, they click on the relevant section, they then have to add some content as to what that problem was. And then we can efficiently deploy the contractors that we use across the country. We use a national database for contractors that are vetted. We make sure they have public liabilities insurance, make sure they have the right qualifications to do the job. And indeed, we manage their costings accordingly, so we can reduce your cost as a client, because we want to maximize your return rather than just willy-nilly go dealing with maintenance issues, which is obviously part of the role. We also want to reduce your costs. And that's what I mean by a slightly different asset managed approach to this process, rather than being a sort of reactive high street lettings and management agent.
Right. Let's get into the brass tacks then. I'm a buyer of property and I need to rent my property out. So I've committed to the purchase. I've made an offer. It's been accepted. Doesn't matter whether it's new build or secondhand. How far out from completion should I be speaking to you in terms of you being able to market that property and start to say, okay, I'm going to need a tenant in here. So when would we start? At the point when I get the offer accepted, when the mortgage offer gets accepted, 2 weeks from completion, what would you say?
First and foremost, you should be in, if you own real estate in the UK already, we should be chatting right away. Because I think it's really important to understand and create a bit of a profile for our clients and understanding what exactly it is that they're looking to achieve as part of their overall wealth management. If they own real estate as an asset class, even if they are in the midway through buying that property, we'd like to have a conversation with them as early on in the process as we possibly can, because it may well be they've already got properties that they own. We tend to migrate properties over for clients as well, even if they're let with other agents. So the client's got a single point of communication. We can migrate over properties that are currently let, and we'll manage that whole process of extracting them from another letting agent. So invariably, we're much more cost effective and we charge very differently to most agents. So in answer to your question, I think we'd like to have a chat. If the client already has exposure or is looking to have exposure in the UK market, let's have a chat ASAP. From a lettings perspective, generally speaking, we would look to pre-market 60 days before completion. So we will create a profile for that property 60 days before completion. But what's really important is we onboard the client as soon as possible, because there are all sorts of things taken into consideration, such as mandatory certification, as I said before, non-resident landlord status, which is a big one. from being a non-resident landlord, if you don't have a non-resident landlord certificate, we have to deduct 20% of the rent at source and pass that on to the revenue. If you get your non-resident landlord certificate, which we can gladly help you obtain in advance, then you won't have that issue. And again, to create or gather all the data to put you on our system, so we've got everything we need, such as bank details, communication details, you know, we create, we agree at that stage on floats and all sorts of things. It would be great to create that profile as early on in the process as we can, but physically marketing 60 days, generally 60 days prior to completion. You know, I think the thing to bear in mind also, in a word to the wise here, we're realists, and a client from a rental perspective will be told what the rent, anticipated rent, will be at the point of sale. And note to self, at the point of sale, let's say traditionally 18 months prior to completion, the rental market could be very different to what it's been now at the point of completion. You know, utilizing COVID as an example of that, there has been a shift in some locations, you know, up to 20-25% in shift in rental. So I think it's very important also to be realistic. And just because you were told a rental figure at the point of sale doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the rent. In some instances, it can go up, of course, but we want to make you aware of that as early on in the process as you can, because heaven forbid, if that rental has gone down, you need to prepare for that, and you need to make sure that you can pay any difference in the short term. Furthermore, at the point of rental, because if it's an investment property that's been sold in a development that maybe has many other investor clients within it, you're going to have a slightly fallow period. You need to be aware of that, because there are lots of properties competing at the same time, and you're better off to be competitive and get a tenant straight away than you are hang in there for the right rental, because you're net zip at the back end of that discussion. So just be aware, in the first rentals when you're most vulnerable, there's going to be competition, but once that development is let through and let out, and all the available property is let, we can then push the rent up over time. We're very good at doing that, at pushing the rent up over time and maintaining, you know, very high levels of occupancy. So you need to be aware that you are vulnerable at that first point of rental, but you know, it will scale up over the next 6 or 12 month period.
And there's a great debate that constantly goes on with property agents and buyers as to what's the best type of property to buy from an investment perspective for rental. Is it a one bed? Is it a two bed? Is it a three bed? I mean, my personal opinion is avoid ground floor if you can. I mean, sometimes there are some good deals, but it would have to be, three beds are great for families, but they're not that popular for generally renting. And I've made the mistake before of buying two bed, one bath, and kind of falling between the cracks of a one bed and a two bed, two bath. Any sweet spots, any guidance that you would offer?
I think it's a good question. I get asked it a lot. I think it also depends on where you're looking to invest also. But there's been an interesting shift for people with two bedrooms from a rental perspective, because a lot of people now are actually quite liking to work from home, and if they can convert that two bedroom into an office and a usable space at home, that's also proving to be quite popular. One and two bedroom apartments traditionally have rented incredibly well. Studios I would veer away from personally. Why? Studio flats tend to be a lot smaller, and sometimes they can be a bit harder to fund. So I'd probably be inclined to stay away from those, but one and two beds predominantly. Interesting shift in if you say about houses can be a great investment, but it's very much dependent on location, who's going to be your end user. And one of the things that we're very good at is corporate tenancy. One of the areas that we have a sweet spot in is that of corporate tenancy. So for instance, Birmingham as a marketplace, we're very strong in and have been for many years. The way in which we let that property is fundamentally different to a typical high street agent. It's worth pointing out that we give our complete RPI gives a multiple route to the letting market, e.g. we will handpick local letting agents on the ground to provide a let only service. We will also utilize the normal property platforms like Rightmove and what have you. Furthermore, we will work in conjunction with the HR departments of many corporates. So in Birmingham, as an example, we work with a lot of the major employers, and they'll be the first people we go to when a property comes up for let to try and source a tenant. So we do a lot of corporate direct letting as well. So it's all very important to understand who's going to be living in that property. Now, if you know it's a huge corporate rental market, does that corporate rental market want to share a three-bedroom house? Yeah, possibly they will. Or is there a big education play? Therefore, there's an argument for moving in families. Yes, also that bears huge relevance. So it's always important at the point of looking at property as well to challenge who's going to be living in it and what's the demographic of that location that will justify the type of property you're looking to buy.
Okay. And buying new build, the next one, I guess, is furniture. To furnish or not to furnish. You buy a flat, it's a one bed, two bed, Birmingham city centre, you're getting it empty. Should somebody be furnishing it and committing before completion, or do they wait? What's your advice?
To furnish or not to furnish, that is the question. I think using, again, Birmingham as an example, as I said before, we manage property across all of the UK, so not just Birmingham, I hasten to add. But Birmingham is very much a furnished marketplace, big corporate furnished marketplace. Historically, there used to be a play for furniture that if you bought furniture, there was you could offset an element of taxation because it was a furnished property. Whereas now that doesn't make a difference. Do you generally achieve more rental because it's furnished at this level? No, not necessarily. Is it a smart move to furnish because you're going to broaden your horizons in terms of occupant? Yes, it is. And I think it would be wise to do it. Are there lots of companies out there that will introduce you to furniture? Yes, there are. Does the quality of that furniture vary? Oh my goodness, yes, it does. And yeah, you know, just lobbing in some IKEA furniture ain't going to cut the mustard when you know, properties take a bit of a beating if they're in an area that's quite transient. We manage that process for the client. We will identify the furniture. We have corporate relationships with furniture suppliers, and we're able to recommend what type of furniture goes in there. Gone are the days. You don't need knives and forks and pots and pans and toasters and all the regalia. You don't need that. What you generally speaking, you'll need is sofas, dining table and chairs, you know, and maybe a couple of pictures on the wall just to dress the apartment. But you don't need rugs. You don't need to go the whole nine yards. You need enough furniture for people to live. So beds. Do you need to produce linen and what have you? No, you don't. But sofas, tables, chairs, beds, I would argue, yes. But please take our lead on that. Furniture packs do vary hugely, and you very much get what you pay for. So just try not to. And again, we're very happy to have a chat with clients. If they want to pick up the phone, have a chat, and they don't want us to manage the property, but they want to have a chat about furnishing or just pick our brains, then, you know, absolutely 100% pick up the blow, and I'll be very happy to help. And we've also got some FAQs on the website. Website www.completerpi.com. He said quick plug there. But no, just be aware that lots of companies will also, at the point of sale, try and offer an incentive of furniture. Again, be aware of that. You don't need to make this call until pre-completion, probably 2 or 3 months before completion. We can turn around a furniture pack inside 2 weeks. If you allow 2 months, gives you loads of time. The reality is that you can't put the furniture in until such time you physically complete on the property. So you need to be aware of that as well. The other thing that a lot of people forget about is blinds. You really do need to put blinds in. You need to put some kind of window dressing. It's not fair to expect a tenant to walk around and people can see you. So you need to give them some kind of privacy. We tend to work with blackout blinds. Again, we can facilitate that process because we manage a lot of properties. We can create some good corporate rates with our furniture suppliers. But I think you can also take the view in some instances, in some marketplaces, I will let the market dictate. So don't go out there and buy that furniture package initially. Don't have that burn initially. Let's let the market dictate. So what you can then do is we can market the property on a furnished versus unfurnished basis. And assuming that it initially starts unfurnished and the tenant does want furniture, then we've got time to negotiate the install of that furniture. I'll give you an example of this because it can be quite a handy negotiating tool, Neil, actually. So let's say, for the sake of argument, the rent is £1,000 a month. The property is currently unfurnished. Had you put the furniture already in the property, the tenant came along and said, I'll sign a 6-month contract, Neil, and I'll pay you £800 a month. Okay, all right, my property's not been let for a while. I might consider that. Alternatively, if the property's unfurnished and the same offer comes to the table, you could turn around and get some leverage and say to the tenant, I tell you what, you pay me the asking price and you sign a 12-month contract and I'll put your furniture in for you. So it does give you quite a nice bit of leverage at that point because it can be done quite swiftly. So I don't want to counter what I just said, but I think the best option is to be flexible. And by saying that you would consider furnishing it, assuming that we can move quickly, which we can, then that is that's often quite a good option because it gives you the flexibility to also negotiate as well.
And is this about the fact that somebody won't rent it unless it's furnished, or does a furnished flat get you more rent? I should imagine it's more the former than the latter, that somebody just needs to move into somewhere and the cost is what it is.
Yeah, it doesn't. And unless you're dealing with a house on your bigger property that warrants, you know, some super duper swanky furniture that's, you know, that's bespoke to that property, I'd argue you don't get more rent. Therefore, it's more about, do I open myself up to a wider marketplace that does want to furnish? Now, interestingly enough, the rest of Europe, big rental culture, predominantly unfurnished. The UK is one of the, you know, last marketplaces that actually does provide furniture. The rest of Europe is predominantly, as I said, an unfurnished marketplace. So I think what you're doing, though, is you're looking at a wider spectrum of clientele. You're invariably, if someone is relocating, they've got a new corporate role, they're relocating from a different part of the country, putting in furniture to house them in that property might mean that you get a slightly longer tenancy. It might mean that somebody doesn't have furniture and you put their own furniture in. Or equally, you could argue if it's unfurnished and someone is prepared to put in their own furniture, they might want to be there slightly longer because they're having to commit to put in their own furniture. But as a rule of thumb, no, you won't, for 1- and 2-bedroom type apartments, get more rent. But what you will do is perhaps command less negotiation at the point of rental, rather than, you know, unfurnished, you might receive an element, and you can probably negotiate slightly better terms in terms of longevity. A typical, what we call an assured shorthold tenancy, is a 12-month contract. Invariably, that has a 6-month break clause. You don't have to have a break clause in there. But again, having a furnished property or arguing this point could allow you to negotiate that accordingly.
Now, I know it's not something that you get involved with, and with my background being mortgage, banks do not like short-term lets at all. So maybe talk a little bit about the tenancy contract and the minimums and maximums that are there, because we've actually got a mortgage application for somebody at the moment, and he's got a 3-year tenancy on it with no break clause, and the bank just won't do it, and it's having to be rewritten. So maybe talk about the generalisms, because sometimes you can do something that you think is a really good thing that actually makes it very difficult if you're not going to be able to get finance or anything else.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think there's the perception that you want as long a period as you possibly can, because we all want that security, and, you know, nothing would give us greater pleasure than signing a 5-year contract. Couple of things to bear in mind there. The norm, as I said, is an assured shorthold tenancy is the terminology, which is a 12-month contract. You have to pay a fixed rent for that period on a monthly or quarterly basis, or sometimes you have something called a premium lease where people will pay the rent in advance, and that does happen quite often with corporate lets. But the most common is a 12-month contract with a 6-month break clause. Therefore, the tenant can serve notice to terminate that contract, as can the landlord, by giving a prerequisite number of days notice. Traditionally, it's 60 days notice. And if the landlord wants to serve notice, it's 90 days notice traditionally. Now, over the COVID period, as I said before, it was actually 6 months. If you want to serve notice to a tenant, you'd have to serve 6 months. That figure's now reduced back, but historically 60 days notice. Now, if you signed a contract longer than that, you can sign a 5-year contract, you can sign a 3-year contract, but still have that break clause after the first 12 months and after the second 12 months. So giving security of tenure for a period longer than 12 months. The banks, of course, don't like that, because how do they get the property back in the event they have to default? And that's why they don't like the fact that there is a longer period of time. So your safest option, in an ideal world, from a landlord's perspective, what you'd want to do is create that longer term contract, but have a break clause only on your side. So you could sign a 3-year contract, for instance, and the tenant's committed to 3 years, but you and you alone have the right to terminate that contract after 12 months, after 24 months, after 36 months. Now, that would be a great contract. And also what you do is you'd put in a what you call a cap and collar rental increase, an RPI increase, which is in line with inflation. Generally speaking, that rental increase is a minimum of 3% and up to a maximum of 6%. So what you do is you would say, okay, you'll pay a fixed rent of, say, £1,000 a month for the first 12 months. End of that 12 months, the rent will go up by 3%. And at the end of the second year, it'll go up by another 3% or 5%, whatever that may be. So in an ideal world, brilliant. Give me a long-term contract, but I can break. If you can break, that would have pleased the bank and the lender, because they know that there is the opportunity to break the contract, but it gives you the security of tenure, knowing you've got somebody in there for a longer period of time. That would be the ideal.
Now, with COVID, there are a lot of clients who've had what I would refer to as serviced apartment deals, certainly in the centre of London, places like that, where, of course, you haven't had the transient flying in, flying out because of closed borders and all the rest of it. And that market seems to have got very, very sticky. Where do you see that in terms of the future? I mean, it was always too good to be true, wasn't it, that you'd get a 5-year deal and you were going to get your rent regardless of whether anybody was in your flat. But that seems to have fractured at the moment.
You can. The good news is a lot of people don't realize you can insure against loss of rental income. Okay. And you can we provide a rental guarantee insurance for clients that they can buy that rental guarantee insurance and legal expenses cover, which means if the tenant chooses not to leave the property for whatever reason and or stops paying rent, you can insure against that risk. So number one, that's a good thing. In terms of, you know, length of tenancy, I think, interestingly enough, what we have seen during COVID is people have been committing to longer term contracts. They want to know they've got the comfort of a 2-year lease in play rather than not. Interestingly enough, you know, perhaps would have thought people might want more flexibility to get out, when in actual fact, we've seen a trend in longer term tenancies. Perhaps people just want to know that they can be fixed and not have to go anywhere and not have to, you know, to move. We don't deal with short-term accommodation. It gets very messy. Short-term sort of B&B type, Airbnb type leasing tends to be not very cost-effective. A lot of people tend to think you could generate a lot more revenue. You can generate some good revenue from shorter-term tenancies, but invariably the utilities need to be included, the billing needs to be included. It's a lot more wear and tear on the property, costs a lot more to manage. The cost of getting a short-term tenancy on an Airbnb type letting is generally double that of a normal managed service. You can pay upwards of 25% for the privilege. People do it themselves, but the majority of people that I know that go down that route, unless it's done professionally, end up getting burnt because, you know, someone's trashed a property or there's been a party or there's been, you know, never underestimate how much maintenance there can be on the back of multiple short-term tenancies. So the longer the tenancy, the better. And one would hope to try and get somebody in that's less transient.
Okay, I'm conscious of time, so maybe just a couple of more questions. Cost of lettings and management, what's the ballpark figure that somebody should be looking to pay these days?
That's another good question. The rack rate in the UK is 15% fully managed. Okay.
15% of the gross rent.
Of the gross rent. That's rack rate. Now, London Southeast, some of the bigger boys, would you believe it, charge up to 17%. The way the industry works is normally you've got 10% to find a tenant, which is an upfront letting fee. You've then got a fee of 12 to 12.5% for rental collection. and a fee of 12.5% to 15% for fully managed. Our blended average across the entire country is about 12.5% fully managed. Now, huge variance in services for that cost. A couple of things to bear in mind. A lot of people will try and woo you in and tell you and say, listen, we provide, charge a much lower management fee, five or 6%. Okay, that's fine. But what do you then charge us at the point of rental? And a lot of people get stuck here or get unstuck here because they don't realize the fee they're paying at the point of rental plus the ongoing management fee ends up being 14, 15, 16%. We only charge our management fee monthly at source. So as the rent comes in, we deduct our commission, we pay you the net balance. We had a client that came to us only last week that was looking to migrate a portfolio of theirs from different parts of the country. And they said, oh, well, my managing agent's only charging us a management fee of 6.5%. So I said, okay, well, let's just do the maths on that. The rent on this particular property was £1,200 a month. They are paying 6.5% every month. But at the point of rental, the agent was charging 1 month's rent as a letting fee. So you had a fee of, it's £1,200 a month. The rent is £1,200. £1,200 times 12 is £14,400 times 6.5% management fee is £936 plus the one-off letting fee of £1,200. That comes to £2,136. So if you do that as an annual figure, 2,136 divided by 14,000, let's say
15%.
The client was paying 15.2%. Good, you did beat the calculator. So you know, all that shines isn't necessarily golden. Look at the detail. A lot of people love to work with us because we only charge monthly. A lot of agents will charge an upfront letting fee at the commencement of the tenancy, then a monthly management fee that eats away at your first couple of months' rent. You don't want that. Lots of ancillary and associated costs ramp up. What are you paying in the second year? We know of a particular firm at the moment that's promoting a new development, and they've wooed the investors in saying, we'll give you free letting and management fee for the first 12 months. Okay, well, that sounds fantastic. But if you peel back the layers of that onion and realize they've got to sign a four-year contract and the gross fee after that is coming in at nearly 20%, do you want to sign a contract like that? I wouldn't. So you just need to make sure that, you know, the devil's in the detail in these things. You have a good look at the contract and understand what all the associated costs are. Understand, you know, furthermore, you get what you pay for. We're a 20-year-old management business, okay? We maintain a 98% occupancy rate. And you know, for somebody to come in and what you get with us for that asset managed approach as well, you're getting far more than just lettings and management service. You're getting a fundamentally different asset managed approach to that process. What does that mean? That means we will reduce your costs. We will maintain your occupancy. We will push your rent upwards. Most lettings and management agents are very reactionary. They don't maintain high levels of occupancy. Therefore, that's a cost to you. They're not very good at enhancing the rent. Most clients we speak to, they say, listen, well, my previous letting agent was, you know, they didn't give us lots of occupancy. The property was unlet a lot of the time. The costs were really expensive. They didn't increase the rent. So you add all those things together, all of a sudden, you know, 12%, but you're getting value add is much, much better than someone who might be charging you slightly less, but leaving your property empty or void and not, you know, screwing their contractors to the floor in terms of cost and not maintaining occupancy. So you get what you pay for in our industry hugely.
Somebody looking to buy a property in the UK wanting strong rent, where should they be buying?
Well, what strong rent? I think this is really important to understand the investor's objective. What do you want? Do you want a mixture of capital growth and yield? Do you just want income or do you just want capital growth? Historically, to get areas like Birmingham at the moment are very popular because they offer a very good blend of capital growth and yield. Yeah. Whereas you can buy in the north of England where the capital value of the property is less and the rent is higher. So your return, your income is greater, but you're not necessarily going to get the capital growth that you're after. And more often than not, people income chase, but at this moment in time in their lives, they don't need the income. So 9 times out of 10, I sit with a client and tells me they're after a blend of the two. And I look at their current portfolios, and they tend to be sitting on cheaper property that's not grown in value, that's costing them money to run, because invariably it's older property. And they're getting income they don't necessarily need, because they don't want that income right now. Probably a smarter move is to say, let's go for a property that's producing less income, but at the very least, washing its face. Now, we produce a very detailed 6-page investment analysis of a client's property or a proposed purchase. We look at all aspects, gearing, it looks at income, it looks at all expenditure down to void period, service charges, maintenance, ground rent, absolutely everything. And it kicks off a whole bunch of numbers at the bottom to see exactly whether that property is profitable or not profitable. 9 times out of 10, you're better off to look for something that provides the best return to you and your best return on capital, which is something that has a better blend of capital growth and yield collectively, rather than just income. In answer to your question at the beginning, if you're just after income and a higher yield, the north of England right now tends to deliver exactly that, whereby your entry level could be as low as £50,000 to £60,000, and you could buy a Victorian 2-bedroom terraced house producing an income of maybe 10-11%, but it's going to cost you more to maintain, and it's not necessarily going to grow in value. Do you really want that income right now, or do you want this exercise to wash its face? Investing in real estate should be a 6 to 10 year play.
And in that 6 to 10 years, we're looking at city centres, we're looking at Birmingham, Manchester.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at
an interesting one.
Yeah, it is. Through to London Southeast corridor into central London, Maidenhead, Reading, Slough. Obviously city centres like the Manchester, the Leicesters, the Leeds of this world, through to Bristol, to Exeter. You know, key university corridors are very good. It's about predominantly connectivity. It's about education. It's about local employment.
And what does the future hold for Complete RPI? I know you've just moved into a brand new office.
Yes, we have a new HQ in Woking, which is amazing, which has taken me 20 years to get there. And we as a business are very, very proud of our new HQ. And it's fantastic to have everybody back in the office. It's fantastic. We're in a good place. We're in a really good place. The company is it's gone from strength to strength. Our market share has increased considerably. We're doing a lot more business, from B2C as well as B2B. I think that the face of our industry is changing daily, and the traditional high street agency approach is not going to be there any longer. And I think that one must realize that over time, it is all about prop tech. It's all about how people communicate with you. It's all about how you can have complete transparency and efficiency to the way in which your property is run. So we're investing heavily in new prop tech at the moment. That's going to make us a bit more automated. It's going to make the customer journey so much easier. It's going to make the customer journey so much more efficient. We've created some lovely new collaborations with the likes of Fine and Country and the Guild of Property that has 800 and something members across the UK. So in answer to your question, exciting times, collaboration and looking after clients in a much more asset managed fashion. We're very proud and thank you for the opportunity of letting us talk today. It's a privilege to work with SJP, and it's exactly the kind of relationship that we like, because ultimately we want long-term relationships. Ultimately, we want to be with that client for the duration that they own the real estate. We don't want them to go anywhere else. And the only way we're going to do that is by providing a very good service from the moment we look after them all the way through to the end of that property life cycle. So what does the future hold? Well, hopefully get to spend a little bit more time down in France, Neil, having the occasional round of golf, but there's life in the old dog yet. Watch this space. There's lots of exciting things happening, and we're at the cold face of an ever-changing marketplace. And I think, we're doing a fantastic job. Clients are very happy, very proud of our staff, and very proud to be asked to be party to conversations like this today.
And a quick plug, if somebody wants to contact you or look up the business, how should they do it?
Thank you very much. Please visit us at our very swanky new website, www.completerpi.com. Please feel free at any point to send me an email. That's rupert.smith@completerpi.com, rupert.smith@completerpi.com. We have a fantastic team of Cantonese and Mandarin speaking staff based in Hong Kong also. But reach out at any point. The website's very interactive, great connectivity. You can book a Calendly meeting with me. We can have book Zoom chats and video links at any moment in time. So, www.completerpi.com or email me directly, rupert.smith@completerpi.com.
Rupert, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining me today on Around the Houses podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it at home.
I have. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And thank you very much indeed. Privilege, and look forward to many more, hopefully.
Thank you for joining us today. If you want to have more in-depth look at any of the topics discussed today, please visit our website at www.ukmortgages.com.hk. I hope you can join us next time for more insights on the UK property market from all of our experts. Bye-bye.